His eyes are dark, sheening as he studies me. My heart feels like a cracked egg, nothing to protect it or hold it in place. I could stay. He looks away.
Nora,
he says quietly, apologetically. Just like that, the tears are back. Charlie brushes the hair from my damp cheek.
You can't make this decision for me, or for Libby,
he says, voice thick and rattling. Why not?
Because, he says, you've spent your life making sure she has everything she needs, and it's time someone made sure you did. You want that job at Loggia, and you fucking love the city. And if you need to save money, take my apartment. It's probably half the price of yours. If that's what you want, that's what you should have. Nothing less.
I try to blink the tears back, instead losing them down my cheeks.
You should have everything,
he says again. What if it's not possible? He tips my jaw up, whispers almost against my lips.
If anyone can negotiate a happy ending, it's Nora Stevens.
Despite, or maybe because of, the sensation of my chest cracking clear in half, I whisper back, I think one of those only costs $40 at spa. He laughs, kisses the corner of my mouth.
That brain.
Neither of us leaves the shop that night. I don't want to leave him, and I don't want him to feel alone in the dark and quiet. Even if it can't last, even if it's just for tonight, I want him to know that I've got him, the way he's had me, the way he has me. For once, I sleep like a rock. In the morning, I stir awake and piece together the night, the fight, finding Charlie at the bookstore, falling into each other again. Afterward, we talked for hours. Books, takeout, family. I told him about how Mom's nose used to crinkle just like Libby's when she laughed, how they wore the same perfume but it smells different on Libby than it did on her. I tell him about Mom's birthday routine, how every December 12th at noon, we'd go to Freeman Books and browse for hours until she picked out one perfect book to buy at full price. Libby and I still go, I said. Or we used to. Every December 12th at noon. 12-12 at 12 o'clock. Mom used to make a big deal of that.
12's a great number,
Charlie said.
Every other number can go to hell.
Thank you, I agreed. At some point, we drifted off, and I wake now to the realization that in our sleep, we've begun to move together again. I kiss him awake, and in a heady fog, we give in to each other, time grinding to a halt, the world fading to black around us. Afterward, I lay my head on his chest and listen to his blood move through his veins, the current of Charlie, as he plays with my hair. His voice is thick and scratchy when he says,
maybe we can figure it out.
Like it's an answer to a question, like the conversation never stopped. All night, all morning, every touch and kiss, all of it was a back and forth, a push and pull, a negotiation or a revision, like everything is between us. Maybe this could work.
Maybe,
I whisper in agreement. We're not looking into each other's faces, and I can't help but think that's purposeful. Like if we looked, we couldn't pretend any longer, and we're not ready to give up the game. Charlie threads his fingers through mine and lifts the back of my hand to his lips.
For what it's worth,
he says,
I doubt I will ever like anyone else in the world as much as I like you.
I slip my arms around his neck and climb into his lap, kissing his temples, his jaw, his mouth. Love, I think, a tremor in my hands as they move into his hair, as he kisses me. The last page ache. The deep breath in after you've set the book aside. When he walks me to the door sometime later, he takes my face in his hands and says,
you, Nora Stevens, will always be okay.
33. Libby sits on the front steps, wrapped in one of Brendan's old sweatshirts, two cups of coffee steaming on the step beside her. Neither of us speaks as I close the distance, but I can tell she spent the night crying, and I doubt I look any better. She holds out a mug. Might be cold by now. I take it, and after another strained second, perch on the step, dew seeping into my jeans.
Should I go first?
She asks. I shrug. We've never been this angry with each other. I don't know what comes next.
I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner,
she says, like she's trying to shove the words through a too narrow doorway. All the way over here, I wondered if laying into her would give me some sense of control, but there's no outcome to force here. What I want is slippery, uncatchable. Those days when there was nothing between us, when we belonged together more than we belonged anywhere else, when it felt like I belonged.
When did we start keeping things from each other?
She looks surprised and hurt, almost impossibly small.
You've always kept things from me, Nora, she says. And I know you were trying to protect me, but it still counts when you pretend things are okay and they're not, or when you try to fix things without me knowing.
So is that what you're doing? I ask. You kept the fact that you were moving away from me so that, what, it wouldn't hurt until the last possible second?
That's not what I was doing.
Fresh tears spring into her eyes. She burrows her fists against them, shoulders twitching.
I'm sorry. I touch her arm. I'm not trying to be mean.
She looks up, wiping her tears away.
I was trying, she says through a shuddering breath, to win you over.
Libby, in what universe do you need to win me over? I'm sorry for making you feel incapable. I was trying to help, but I never thought you needed to be fixed. Never.
That's not what I mean, she says. I wanted to win you over to...
She waves toward the meadow and the sun-dappled footbridges, the flowering bushes swaying in the breeze, and the thick piney forest covering the rolling hills. And then the rest of it clicks. The list wasn't about Libby trying on her new life, and it wasn't about saying some spectacular goodbye or making a last-ditch effort to save me from a life of sleeping alone with my laptop. It was a sales pitch.
Brendan wanted me to tell you right away, she goes on. But I thought that maybe if you came here, if you saw what it could be like, I wanted you to come with us.
Her voice cracks.
And I thought if you realized what life could be here, maybe even met someone, you would want that too. But then you started spending time with Charlie, and God, it's been so long since I've seen you like that, Nora. I was going to let the whole thing go, but then you said he was staying, and it just seemed like you could want this too. Like I could have all this, and you.
I feel so empty, wrung out, like I've been treading water for weeks, only to realize the shore was a mirage.
This is Libby, who never asked for anything until a month ago, admitting what she really wants. For me to follow her. And I want to give her what she wants. I always want her to have everything she wants. All the organized compartments in my mind came crashing down last night, and for the first time, I see it all clearly. Not the tidy, controlled version of things, but the mess of it, when it all spills loose. Libby and I have been caught in a slow boil of change for a long time, one path splitting into two. There's no less room in my heart for her than the day she first came screaming into the world. But there is less time, less space in our daily lives, other people, other priorities. We're a Venn diagram now instead of a circle. I might have made all my decisions for her, but now that I'm here, I love my life.
I was asked to apply for another editing job. I get out.
Libby blinks rapidly, tears clinging to her sparkly blue eyes.
What?
I stare at the tree line beyond the meadow. Charlie's job at Loja, I say. They want someone local, and he's staying here. So he mentioned it to Dusty's editor. I'd be taking over some of his list, and then I'd start acquiring my own, too.
It's your dream,
Libby says breathlessly. Something about that word sets off fireworks through my body. Nothing else comes out. She reaches for my hands, squeezing them hard, her voice cracking.
You have to do it.
My chest cramps as I study her, the only face I know better than mine.
You have to,
she says through tears.
It's what you want. It's what you've always wanted. And don't put it off again, Nora. It's your dream.
It's not something I've... I wave my hand in a vague spiral.
Done before?
She says. And if it didn't work out...
You can do it,
she tells me.
You can do it, Nora. And if you fail, who cares?
Well, I say, me. Her arms coil around my neck. She shakes with something halfway between more sobs and giggles.
You're going to have the world's best guest room here,
she cries.
And if everything goes to shit there, you'll come stay with us. I'll take care of you, okay? I'll take care of you how you've always, always taken care of me, Nora.
I want to tell her how perfect these last 3 weeks have been. I want to tell her this is the happiest I can remember being in so long, and it's also the worst pain I've ever felt. Because all those gaps between us are finally gone, but the impact of the collision has shaken every last remnant of the ice loose, leaving nothing but a soft, pulpy tenderness. So all I can do is cry with her. Somehow, it never occurred to me that this was an option, that two people in the same hug could both be allowed to fall apart, that maybe it's neither of our jobs to keep a steel spine, that we can both survive this pain without the other shouldering it.
I don't know how to be without you, Nora,
Libby squeaks.
I never thought I would be, and I know this is right for me and Brendan, but fuck, I thought you and I would always be together. How is it possible for two people who belong together to belong in two different places?
Maybe I won't even get the job, I say.
No,
Libby replies with force.
Don't try to fix it. Don't choose me over you, okay? We've done this for years, and it's almost broken us. It's time to just be sisters, Nora. Don't fix it. Just be here with me and say it fucking sucks.
It does. I scrunch my eyes tight. It fucking sucks. I didn't know the power of those words. They fix nothing, do nothing. But just saying them feels like planting a stake into the ground, pinning us together, at least for this moment. It sucks, and I can't change that, but I'm here with my sister, and somehow we'll get through it. You can take the city person out of the city, but the city will always be in them. I think it's the same for sisters. Anywhere we go, we won't leave each other. We couldn't even if we wanted to, and we don't. We never will. Brendan meets the home inspector at the house, but Libby and the girls stay back with me, giving him some much-needed quiet after his weeks as a solo parent. They're not moving in earnest until November, a month before number 3's due date. Until then, Brendan will be back and forth getting the house ready. 2.5 months. That's how long we have left together, and it's going to count. We spend the morning wandering the woods, trying to keep the girls on the trail, and Googling what does poison ivy look like every 45 seconds, never getting any closer to a concrete answer. We take them to the fence, and the horses clomp over eagerly to be petted, despite our lack of bait.
I guess we know where you and I stand,
Libby jokes as the girl's little fingers swipe down a chestnut mare's pink snout. Afterward, we take the tin buckets from the cottage's cabinet out to the blackberry thicket at the edge of the meadow and pick and eat plump berries until our fingers and lips are stained purple and our shoulders are sunburnt. By the time we arrive home, our knees smudged with dirt, Tala is fully asleep in my arms, sticky and warm, and we pour her onto the couch to keep napping. B leads us into the kitchen to explain the art of blind baking a pie crust for the blackberries. She and Brendan have watched a lot of Great British Baking Show this month, and I still feel like a city person through and through. But maybe it's possible to have more than one home. Maybe it's possible to belong in 100 different ways to 100 different people and places. 34. The girls are tucked into the air mattress in the upstairs bedroom. I've been relocated to the fold-out couch, but Brendan, Libby, and I stay up late, picking over the leftovers of Bee's blackberry pie. Someone knocks on the door, and Brendan kisses Libby's forehead on his way to answer it.
Nora, he calls. For you.
Charlie's standing in the doorway, his hair damp and his clothes perfectly wrinkle-free. He looks like a million bucks. Actually, more like 600, but 600 very well-appointed dollars.
Up for a walk?
He asks. Libby shoves me out of my chair.
She sure is.
Outside, we wander across the meadow, our hands catching and holding. It's been years since I've held anyone's hand other than Libby's or Bee's or Tala's. It makes me feel young, but not in a bad way. Less like I'm powerless in an uncaring world, and more like everything is new, shiny, undiscovered. The way Mom saw New York, that's how I see Charlie. When we reach the moonlit gazebo, he faces me.
I think we need to consider an alternate ending.
I balk. We already sent the notes. Dusty's been working on edits all week. She's...
Not for Frigid.
He lifts our hands, holds them against his chest, where I can feel his heart speeding. His eyes bore into me. Black hole eyes. Sticky trap eyes. Decadent dessert eyes.
We take turns visiting each other,
he says seriously.
Once a month, maybe. And when you're able, you come here for holidays. And when you can't, I get my sister and her husband to fly out and be with my parents so I can get up to New York. We video call and text and email as much as we're able. Or, if that's too much, I don't know, maybe we skip all of that. When you're in the city, you're working. And when we're together, we're together.
My stomach feels like it's overstuffed with drunken, glittering fireflies. Like an open relationship?
No.
He shakes his head.
But if that's what you'd prefer, I don't know. We could try it. I don't want to, but I will.
I don't want that either, I tell him, smiling. He releases a breath.
Thank fuck.
My heart twists. Charlie...
Just consider it,
he presses quietly. It didn't work for Sally and Clint, for me and Jacob, Charlie and Amaya. Even if I can overcome my travel anxiety, even if Charlie doesn't mind talking me down in the dead of night, how am I supposed to deal with the constant fear of losing him? The anxiety every time he cancels a call or a visit falls through, waiting for the other shoe to drop, for the day he finally says, I want something different. It's not you. I want someone different. A slow, excruciating heartbreak unfolding bit by bit for weeks. I'd take a swift beheading over that death by 1,000 paper cuts every time. Long distance never works, I say. You said that yourself.
I know,
he says.
But it's never been us, Nora.
So we're the exception? I say, skeptical. The people it just works out for.
Yes,
he says.
Maybe. I don't know.
His eyes rove over me as he regroups.
What else can we do, Nora? I'm open to notes. Tell me what you'd change. Get out your fucking pen and shred it all up and tell me how it's supposed to end.
It actually hurts to smile. My voice sounds like it's scraping over broken glass.
We enjoy this week. We spend as much time together as we want, and we don't talk about after. And then I leave, and I don't say goodbye, because I'm not good at them. I've never really said one, and I don't want to start with you. So instead, when I kiss you for the last time, neither of us draws attention to it. And then I get on a plane and go home, incredibly grateful for the life-ruiningly hot man I once spent a month with in North Carolina. He stares at me, his eyes focused and brow furrowed as he absorbs what I said, his lips pouting. It's his editing expression. And when it clears, he shakes his head and says, "No." I laugh, surprised. "What?" He straightens, steps in close.
"I said no."
"Charlie, what does that even mean?"
"It means," he says, eyes glinting, "you'll have to do better than that."
I smile despite myself, hope thrashing around in my belly like a very determined baby bird with a broken wing.
"I'll expect notes by Friday," he says.
The rest of the week, we're running. Libby's working on the fundraiser ball. Brendan's finishing the final phases of the mortgage process. Charlie's at the register, and Sally's in and out nonstop, getting everything ready for the virtual book club with Dusty. There's a new sign in the window, reading, "Make good choices, buy good books," and a poster of Dusty's face advertises both the book club and the once-in-a-lifetime Blue Moon Ball. Volunteers transform the town square, and technically I've called off for the week, but some things won't wait, so I do my best to squeeze in bits of work in between giving the girls piggyback rides and cleaning up my resume for Loja. I've always thought of myself as a creature of survival, but lately I've been daydreaming about a new job, about Charlie, about having everything all at once. So in that way, maybe this place did transform me, just not into a girl who loves flannel and pigtail braids. When we're together, Charlie and I don't keep our distance or circle each other warily. We give in to every moment we can, but we don't talk about the future. When we're apart, though, we keep the story going over calls and texts. "You'll spend Christmas in Sunshine Falls, and I'll spend New Year's Eve in the city," he says. "We'll get up early and train hop until we find a mariachi band," I say. "We'll go to town hall meetings and involve ourselves in public feuds, then go back to the cottage and have sex all night," he says. "And we'll do a taste test of all the dollar slices in the city. We'll get to the bottom of the cubed ham salad at PS," I say. "I believe in you so deeply, Nora," he says. "But not even you can unlock the secret of that great mystery." "I'll be so busy," I remind him. "For the first couple months when I get back, I'll be cramming in time with Libby and the girls, and if I get the Loja job, tapering off my agency work, offloading my clients to another agent. Then there will be the learning curve of stepping into a new role." "Busy doesn't scare me," Charlie says. This, I think, is what it is to dream. And I finally understand why Mom could never give it up, why my authors can't give it up, and I'm happy for them because this wanting, it feels good, like a bruise you need to press on, a reminder that there are things in life so valuable that you must risk the pain of losing them for the joy of briefly having them. Sometimes I write to Charlie. The first act is the fun part, and then everything gets too complicated. "Stevens," he replies, "for us, it's all the fun part." It hurts, but I let the dream go on a while longer. No one will ever convince me that time moves at a steady pace. Sure, your clock follows some invisible command, but it feels like it's randomly spouting off minutes at whatever intervals suit it, because this week is a blip and then Friday night arrives. Another heat wave breaks, ushering in fall weather, and we set up the tent and air mattress again. While Libby and Brendan walk into town to pick up Quattro Stagioni pizza, the girls and I lie on our backs, watching the sky darken.
B tells me about everything she and Brendan have baked over the last few weeks. Tala regales us with a tale that is either the nonsense ramblings of a toddler or a faithful retelling of a Kafka novel. After we've eaten, Libby suggests Brendan take the king bed to himself tonight, and he says, mid-yawn,
"Oh, thank God."
When he kisses the girls goodnight, they're so sleepy they hardly react, except for Tala reaching her little arms up toward his face for a second before letting them flop down on her tummy. He kisses Libby last, then gives me a side hug, world's worst hugger, and I feel a bigger crush of love for him than I did the day he married my sister.
"What the hell?"
Libby whispers, laughing.
"Are you crying?"
"Shut up." I toss a pillow at her.
"You broke my eye muscles. I can't stop it now." "You're crying because you love Brendan so much," she teases. "Admit it." "I love Brendan so much," I say, laughing through the tears. "He's nice."
Libby's laughter escalates.
"Dude, I know."
Tala grumbles and rolls over, her arm flinging across her eyes. Libby and I lie back side by side and hold each other's hands as we study the improbable number of constellations.
"You know what?"
Libby whispers. "Probably," I say, "but try me."
"Even if you can't see them back in Manhattan, all of those stars will be over you too. Maybe every night we look up at the sky at the same time."
"Every night?" I say, dubious.
"Or once a week," she says. "We get on the phone, and we look up at the sky, and then we'll know we're still together, wherever we go."
I swallow a rising lump. "Mom will be with you too," I say. "Just because you're leaving New York, it doesn't mean you're leaving her behind." Libby snuggles closer, resting her head on the divot of my shoulder, the smell of crushed blackberries still lingering in her hair.
"Thank you."
"For what?"
"Just,"
she says,
"thank you."
For once, I don't dream about Mom. 35. The center of town is a wonderland of string lights and bunting. Long tables covered in pretty gingham cloths and loaded with pies. A dance floor sits in the square, and a branded Coors truck sells beer behind the gazebo. Next to it, Amaya and Mrs. Struthers hawk donated wine, every glass poured with a heavy hand. I doubt they have the permits for most of this stuff, but then again, Libby made it sound like just about everyone at that town hall meeting was involved in one way or another in making this happen, so there's a small chance this is all above board. Brendan, Libby, the girls, and I stop by Good Books to catch Dusty's event, but the place is packed, and we don't linger long. Charlie and Sally arranged all the new furniture, along with the old folding chairs, into rows in the cafe, with Dusty's video conference projected onto the far wall and her audio playing through the shop speakers so that even the overflow of visitors could hear while they shopped. The girls are bouncing off the walls, so we take them over to Mug and Shot's pop-up soda shop for frothy pink cows.
"This is a huge mistake,"
Libby notes as she passes the red soda and ice cream plus whipped cream concoctions to Bee and Tala. "A delicious one, though," I point out. "And," Brendan adds, dropping his voice, "they always crash after a sugar blitz." Back in the town square, we gorge ourselves on popcorn, on chocolate pie and rhubarb, on sugar-dusted pecans that make me think of cold mornings in Central Park, and on one local wine that has to be the worst I've ever had, along with another that's actually pretty good. We dance with the girls to pop songs Bee somehow knows better than Libby or I, and as the night wears on and total darkness falls, bringing a slight chill with it, Tala falls asleep in Brendan's arms while he and Clint Lastra are talking about catch-and-release fishing spots. Brendan's never fished in his life, but he's determined to try, and Clint's happy to get him started. "Libby's going to be happy here," I think, as I watch them from a distance. She's going to be so fucking happy, and that will make the distance bearable. Almost. She and Bea slip off to see if they can find some sweatshirts or blankets in Brendan's rental car, but I hang back, watching Gertie and her girlfriend, the bickering couple from town hall, and a dozen other pairings sleepily sway on the dance floor. I spot Shepard in a gap in the crowd, and he gives me a sheepish smile and wave before ambling over.
"Hey there,"
he says. "Hey," I say. After an awkward moment, I begin. "I'm sorry about," right as he's saying,
"just wanted to say."
He smiles again, that handsome, leading man smile.
"You go first."
"I'm sorry if I misled you," I say. "You're a great guy." He gives another warm, albeit vaguely disappointed, smile.
"Just not your kind of great guy."
"No," I admit, "I guess not. But if you're ever in New York and you need a tour guide or a wingman,
I'll look you up."
He stifles a yawn with the back of his hand.
"I used to being up this late,"
he says apologetically.
"I should turn in."
Of course he's a morning person. Life with Shepard would be a lot of slow, romantic sex with intensely loving eye contact, followed by watching the sunrise over the valley. He will, no doubt, be part of someone's happy ending. Maybe he belongs to someone already, in a way that can't be explained. For someone else, he will be easy in the best way. As if the thought has conjured him, Charlie appears a few yards behind Shepard, and my heart lifts, warm and reliable as old faithful. Shepard catches me looking away, a sunflower finding its light source. He follows my gaze straight to Charlie and smiles knowingly.
"Have a good flight, Nora."
"Thanks," I say, blushing a little at my own transparency. "Take care, Shepard." He walks off, pausing for a moment to talk to Charlie on his way to the edge of the town square. Smiles are exchanged. Charlie's a bit wary, but not so guarded as that day outside Good Books. Shepard claps him on the shoulder as he says something, and Charlie looks toward me, that geyser of affection erupting in my chest again at his faint smile. With a few more words, they part ways, Shepard making his way to the fringes of the crowd, and Charlie coming toward me with his smile tugging whiter.
"I heard you might be cold,"
he says quietly. He holds out a bundled-up flannel shirt I hadn't noticed him carrying. I glance toward where Libby and Bea have rejoined Brendan, and Libby flashes me a quick smile. "Wow," I say. "Word does travel fast here."
"Once in high school," he says, "I went to a barber on a whim and got my head shaved. My parents knew before I got home."
"Impressive," I say.
"Demented."
He holds the flannel up, and I turn, feeling like a delicate socialite in an old black-and-white movie as he slips it over my arms, then turns me back to him and starts buttoning it. "Is this yours?" I ask.
"Absolutely not," he says. "I bought it for you."
At my surprise, he laughs.
"It was on your list. I got Libby one, too. She screamed when I handed it to her. I thought she was going into labor."
For a few moments, we just smile at each other. It's the least awkward extended eye contact of my life. It feels like we've both signed on for the same activity, and this is it, existing at each other. "How do I look?" I say.
"Like a very hot woman," he says, "in a very unimpressive shirt."
All I heard was hot. His mouth splits into, quite possibly, my favorite of his various smiles, the one that makes it look like there's a secret tucked up in one corner of his mouth.
"Do you want to dance, Stevens?"
"Do you?" I ask, surprised.
"No," he says, "but I want to touch you, and it's a good cover."
I take his hand and pull him out onto the dance floor, beneath the twinkling lights, while James Taylor's Carolina in My Mind plays like the universe just wants to tease me. Charlie folds my hand up in his warm palm and I rest my cheek against his sweater, closing my eyes to focus on how this feels. I imprint every detail of him on my mind, the scent of book and citrus, with the almost spicy note that's all his own, the soft, fine wool and firm chest underneath it, the eager, pulpy thud of his heart, his cheek brushing my temple, the indescribable shivery feeling when he nestles his mouth into my hair and breathes me in.
"Are you excited to eat?"
he says quietly. I open my eyes to study his thick, serious brows. "I already ate. I had pie dinner." He half shakes his head.
"I mean when you get back to the city."
"Oh." I press my cheek into his shoulder, fingers curling in, trying to keep him, or me, here a while longer.
"We don't have to talk about that."
His hands gently increase their pressure for a moment.
"I don't mind."
I close my eyes against tears, and after a pause say, "I've been craving Thai."
"There's a great Thai restaurant around the corner from my apartment," he says. "I'll take you someday."
I let myself picture it again. Charlie in my apartment, his laptop in front of him, his face stern as he reads on my sofa, ice hiding in the corners of the window pane behind him, snowflakes melting across the glass, Christmas lights wrapped around the lampposts on the street below, people carrying oversized shopping bags past. I let myself imagine this feeling lasting. I imagine a world within a world just for Charlie and me, moving the stone walls back a few feet to fit him inside them and not spending every second looking for the cracks. This, I think again, is what it is to dream. And then, because I have to, because if anyone deserves honesty, it's Charlie, I invite the truth forward to replace the story. Me, working 12-hour days, trying to offload my clients, then settle into a new job. Charlie, exhausted from long days at the bookstore, weekends at physical therapy appointments with his dad, hours worth of Googling how to fix leaky sinks and replace loose shingles. Missed calls, unanswered texts piling up, hurt, grief, missing each other. Visits canceled for work or family emergencies, both of us stretched too thin, our hearts spanning too many states, the tension unbearable. My chest squeezes so tight it hurts. He told me someone needed to make sure I have what I need, but he deserves that too. My heart races, and my body feels like it's on the verge of coming apart. Charlie. There's a long silence. His throat bobs as he swallows. His voice is a hoarse, growly whisper.
"I know, but don't say it yet."
We don't look at each other. If we look, we'll know this game of make-believe is over, so we just hold on to each other. His long-distance relationship was the worst year of his life. Mine almost broke me. He's right that it's different, that it's us, and we understand each other, but that's why I can't do it. "A week ago," I say, "I liked you so much, I would have wanted to try to make this work." I swallow a jagged, fist-sized lump, but still my voice has to scrape by to get out. "But now I think I might love you too much for that." I'm surprised to hear myself say it. Not because I was unaware of how I felt, but because I've never been the first person to say the L word, not even with Jacob. "You don't have to say anything," I hurry to add. His jaw flexes against my temple.
"Of course I love you, Nora. If I loved you any less, I'd be trying to convince you that you could be happy here. You have no idea how badly I wish I could be enough."
"Charlie," I begin.
"I'm not being self-deprecating,"
he promises softly against my ear.
"I just don't think that's how it works in real life."
"If anyone could be enough," I say, "I think it might be you." His arms squeeze around me, his voice dropping to a soft scratch.
I'm glad we had our moment, even if it didn't last as long as we wanted it to.
The tears are so thick in my eyes that the dance floor dissolves into streaks of color and light. But I finally get out, my eyes scrunching shut. It really was fucking perfect.
You're going to be okay, Nora,
he whispers against my temple, his hands loosening.
You're going to be better than okay.
Just like I asked, there's no goodbye. When the song ends, he presses one last kiss against the curve of my jaw. My eyes flutter closed. When I open them, he's gone. But I still feel him everywhere. I am Heathcliff. As I escape toward the dark edge of the town square, I fire off a text to Libby and Brendan, telling them that I'll meet them at home.
You taking off?
I not only yelp in surprise, but throw my purse. It crashes into a planter.
Didn't mean to scare you.
Clint Lastra sits on a bench, his walker beside him, a few stray moths circling overhead. I retrieve my purse, wiping at my eyes as discreetly as I can. Early flight tomorrow. He nods.
I wouldn't mind getting to bed either, but Sal won't let me out of her sight.
He casts me a wry look.
It's hard getting old. Everyone treats you like a kid again.
I would have given anything to see my mom get old. It's out before I realize it wasn't just a note in my brain.
You're right.
Clint says.
I'm lucky. Still, can't help but feel like I'm failing him.
I feel my brows flick up. Who? Charlie? The corner of his mouth flinches downward.
It wasn't supposed to be like this. He shouldn't be here.
I balk, torn for a moment about how much, if anything, to say. I've barely spoken to Clint in the weeks I've been here. Maybe not, I say tightly. But it means a lot to him to get to be here for you. It's important to him. Clint gazes wistfully toward the crowd on the dance floor, where Charlie and I stood together moments ago.
He won't be happy.
I'm not sure it's that simple. It's not like I wouldn't be happy if I were here with Libby. It's more that it would feel like I was borrowing someone's genes, or like I was taking a break from my own life, like this was a period of time when I'd sidestepped out of my own path for a while. I've done that before, and I've never had regrets exactly. There have always been things to be grateful for. That's life. You're always making decisions, taking paths that lead you away from the rest before you can see where they end. Maybe that's why we as a species love stories so much. All those chances for do-overs, opportunities to live the lives we'll never have. He wants to be here for you and Sally, I say. He's working so hard to be what he thinks you need. Confirmed sweet guy Clint Lastra wipes at his cheek. His hands shake a little when they rest against his leg.
He's always been special,
Clint says.
Like his mom. But sometimes, well, I think Sally's always enjoyed standing out a bit.
His mouth twists.
I think my son has spent most of his life feeling lonely.
Clint glances sidelong at me, appraising, that same X-ray sensation his son's so good at evoking.
He's been different these last few weeks.
Clint laughs to himself.
You know, I used to try to read a book a month with him. Did it all through high school and college, too. I'd ask for recommendations. Last thing he'd read and loved, so we'd always have something to talk about that mattered to him. He was probably 14 years old the first time I read one of his books and thought, shit, this kid's outgrown me.
When I start to argue, Clint lifts a hand.
I don't mean that in a self-deprecating way. I'm a smart enough man in my way. But I'm amazed by my son. I could listen to that kid talk for way longer than he ever would about pretty much anything. The first time Sal and I visited him in New York, it all made perfect sense. It was like he'd been living at half volume until that moment. That's not what a parent wants for their kid.
Half volume.
He's been different these last few weeks.
In the twitch of his mouth, I see shades of his son, biological or not.
More comfortable. More himself.
I've been different, too. I wonder if I've been living at half volume, too. With agenting, with dating, tamping myself into a shape that felt sturdy and safe instead of right. You know, I say cautiously, not wanting to out Charlie in any way, but also needing to be in his corner. To not choose politeness or likability or winning over anyone over him. Maybe you're trying to prove you don't need him because you think he doesn't want to be here. But don't act like he's not doing any good or like he can't help. This place already gave him enough reason to feel like he was the wrong kind of person, and the very last person he needs to get that from is you. White rings his eyes. He opens his mouth to object. It doesn't matter whether that's how you feel or not, if that's how it looks to him, I say. And if you do let him help you, he'll do it better than you ever expected. With that, I turn and walk away before any more tears can fall. 36. When I step out of the building into the crisp September afternoon, a flurry of pink and orange hurls itself at me. Libby's lemon lavender scent wraps around my shoulders as she squeals, "You did it!" If by it, I say, you mean completed the first step of an interview process that might go nowhere, then I sure did. She pulls back, beaming. Her hair has faded almost entirely back to blonde, but her clothes are as colorful as ever.
What did they say?
They'll be in touch, I reply. She threads her arm through mine and turns me up the sidewalk.
You've got it.
Nerves jostle in my stomach. I feel like it's the first day of school, I'm naked, and I forgot my locker combination. Wait, no, it's the last day of school, and I never went to math, plus all those other things.
The uncertainty is good for you, she says. You really want this, sissy. That's a good thing. Now, let's go. I'm famished. Do you have the list?
Oh, do you mean this list? I say, producing the laminated sheet she made of everything we need to eat, drink, and do before she leaves. Most days I see her, for lunch, or a walk to the playground by her place, or to sit on the living room floor packing stuffed animals and tiny overalls into cardboard boxes. Sometimes I cry over particularly tiny onesies that used to belong to Bee, then to Tala, and will soon be inherited by number 3. One Saturday, we take the girls to the Museum of Natural History and spend 2.5 hours in the room with the huge whale. Another night, Brendan and Libby and I meet at our favorite pizza place in Dumbo, and we stay out on the patio talking until the staff is cleaning up for the night. We overpay to have our caricatures drawn at Central Park. We ask a tourist to take our family picture at Bethesda Fountain. We meet for crepes Sunday after Sunday at Libby's favorite spot in Williamsburg. And then November comes. They leave on a Thursday, bright and early. The girls are so sleepy that we're able to plop them into the U-Haul without much fanfare. And secretly, I'm disappointed. It kills me to hear them crying over the words Aunt No-No, but to not hear them might be worse. Brendan and I hug goodbye, and then he climbs into the rental truck to give me and Libby some privacy.
Run,
I stage whisper to Libby, and he shoots me a smile before pulling the door shut. Libby's already crying. She said she woke up crying. I didn't, but then again, I'm not sure I slept. The third time I jolted awake, I got online and made appointments with both a therapist and a sleep specialist, then ordered 4 books that promised to have helped millions in my exact situation. It was almost nice to have something else to focus on in the dead of night.
We'll talk all the time, Libby promises. You're going to be sick of me.
There's an iciness to the wind, and I lift her chilly fingertips to breathe warmth into them. She rolls her eyes, laughing tearily.
Still such an utter mom.
You're one to talk. I bend down to kiss her belly.
Be good, number three, and Auntie Nono will bring you a present when she visits. A motorcycle, maybe, or some party drugs.
I don't know what to say.
Libby's voice cracks. I pull her into a hug. This sucks. She relaxes in my arms.
This does indeed suck.
But it also rules, I point out. You're going to have a big-ass house and windows that don't face that old guy who never wears pants. And you're going to have a garden, and you'll wear those overpriced prairie dresses when you host dinner parties with fresh floral arrangements on every surface. And your kids are going to stay out late catching fireflies with the neighbor kids. And Brendan's probably going to learn how to, like, chop wood and get ripped and carry you around like you're in a romance novel.
And then you're going to visit, Libby cuts in. And we're going to stay up all night talking. We're going to drink one too many gin and tonics, and I'm going to convince you to sing Sheryl Crow with me at Papa Squat's karaoke night. And we're going to go to a real Christmas tree farm, not just a tent in an alleyway. And we're going to show the girls Philadelphia Story. And they're going to say, hey, am I mistaken, or is Cary Grant kind of being an asshole? Why wouldn't she end up with Jimmy Stewart?
And we'll have to tell them that some people simply have bad taste. I agree solemnly.
Or that sometimes there are not one but two hot men vying for your heart, and you have to spin in a circle and choose one at random, then marry the other off to his co-worker.
Babe, Brendan calls from the truck, grimacing apologetically. Libby nods in understanding, and we draw apart, still gripping each other's forearms like we're preparing to spin in circles at full speed and don't want inertia to pull us apart. Pretty accurate, actually.
This isn't goodbye,
she says. Of course not, I say. Nadine Winters never remembers to say hello or goodbye.
Also, we're sisters, she says. We're stuck together.
That too. She lets go of me and climbs up into the truck. As they pull away, my eyes fill up. At least the tears held off this long. At least I earned them. The white and orange of the U-Haul melt together until it's like I'm looking at a watercolor painting that's been left out in the rain, my family disintegrating into colorful streaks. I watch the blur of them shrink away. One block, then two, then three. Then they turn, and they're gone. And it feels like I'm a concrete slab that's just been cracked in half, only to realize my insides never quite set. I'm mush. I'm crying hard now. Not cute little sniffs, ugly, gasping breaths. People walk by on the sidewalk. Some give me a wide berth. Others shoot me sympathetic looks. As one woman around my age passes, she holds out a tissue to me without so much as slowing her pace, and I clutch it like a baby blanket, unable to do anything but cry harder and laugh, my abdomen ricocheting between the two. It's like Mom used to say, you're not a true New Yorker until you're willing to feel your emotions out in the open, and only now, having made a firm decision to stay, have I crossed that last threshold. I drop onto Libby's stoop, her former stoop, laughing and crying so hysterically I can no longer discern one from the other. Only once my phone starts to ring do I manage to get any kind of hold on myself. I sniff, clearing out some of my tears as I free my phone from my pocket and read the screen. Libby, I answer. Is everything okay?
What's up?
She says.
Nothing.
I smear the backs of my hands across my eyes.
You?
Not a lot, she sighs. I just missed you. Thought I'd call and say hi.
Warmth fills my chest. It creeps into my fingers and toes until there is so much of it, it hurts. I'm overfilled. No one person should ever have quite so much love in their body at one time.
What's New York look like right now?
She asks. They've been gone 8 minutes.
Did Brendan's foot fall off onto the gas pedal or something?
Just tell me, she says. I want to hear you describe it.
I look around at the hustle and bustle, the trees pushing out their first spurts of reds and yellows across their leaves, a man unloading crates of fruit at the bodega across the street, an old lady with jet black hair under a white rhinestoned cowboy hat picking through the DVDs for sale on some guy's folding table. Libby and I took a glance before we parted ways and realized 85% of the collection featured Keanu Reeves, which begs the question, did this man and Keanu Reeves have some great falling out? I smell kebab cooking down the street, and in the distance car horns blare, and a woman who may or may not be an actress I've seen on SVU hurries past in huge sunglasses, walking a tiny, prancing Boston Terrier.
Well, Libby says,
it looks like home.
Same old, same old.
I knew it.
I can hear her smiling. She wanted me to go with her, but she's happy that I'm getting what I want. I wanted her to stay, but I hope she finds everything she's looking for and more. Maybe love shouldn't be built on a foundation of compromises, but maybe it can't exist without them either. Not the kind that forces two people into shapes they don't fit in, but the kind that loosens their grips, always leaves room to grow. Compromises that say, there will be a U-shaped space in my heart, and if your shape changes, I will adapt. No matter where we go, our love will stretch out to hold us, and that makes me feel like everything will be okay. 37. On December 12th at 11:20, I make my way over to Freeman Books. It's the one day a year I've always taken off at the agency, and as soon as I started at Loja Publishing, I requested the 12th off there too. The learning curve is brutal, but after so many years of knowing exactly how to do my job, the challenge is exhilarating. I comb through each of my newly inherited author's manuscripts like an archaeologist at a newly discovered dig site. Is it possible to be a zealot for editing books? If so, that's what I am. I almost hated to miss work today, but if I'm going to be out of the office, at least I'll still be surrounded by words. I take my time walking, enjoying a surprise bout of sunshine that melts the snow into slushy lumps on the sidewalk, the feeble warmth seeping into my favorite herringbone coat. At the diner where Mom used to work, I buy a cup of coffee and a Danish. It's been a long time since anyone recognized me here, but I'm pretty sure the same cashier rang up Libby and me last December 12th, and that's enough to fill me with a pleasant sense of belonging. And then the sharp ache, like I've brushed up against the blistered part of my heart. Charlie should be here. I don't avoid thinking about him like I used to do with Jacob. Even if it hurts when he shimmers across my mind, it's like remembering a favorite book. One that left you gutted, sure, but also one that changed you forever. I pass a flower shop with a heated plastic tent propped up around its storefront and duck in to buy a bouquet of deep red petals sprinkled with silvery green leaves and tiny white blossoms. I don't know flower types, but for these to be blooming in winter, they must be hardy, and I respect them for that. At 11:45, I'm still two blocks away, and my phone vibrates in my coat pocket. Shifting the bouquet into the crook of my arm, I fish around in my pocket, then tug my glove off with my teeth to swipe the phone unlocked and read Libby's message. Happy birthday, she writes, like she's sending the text straight to Mom. Happy birthday, I write back, my chest stinging. It's hard to be apart today. It's the first time I've had to do this without her. FaceTime later, she writes. Of course, I say. She types for a minute as I hurry across the last block. Did you get my present yet? Since when do we do presents for Mom's birthday? I write. Since we have to be apart for it, she says. Well, I didn't get you anything.
That's fine, she says. You can owe me. But you haven't gotten yours yet?
No, I write. I'm out.
Ah, she says. At Freeman's already?
In about 3 seconds.
I shoulder the door open and step into the familiar, dusty warmth.
I'll let you go, she says. But send a pic when the present gets there, okay?
I reply with a thumbs up and a heart, then drop my phone and gloves into my pockets, freeing my hands to browse. I head straight for the romance shelves. This year, I'll buy 2 copies of whatever I choose and mail one to Libby. Or better yet, take it with me when I visit her for the holidays and number 3's birth. As I wander along the hundreds of pristine spines, time unspools around me, the current slowing. I have nowhere to be, nothing to do but peruse summaries and pull quotes on dust jackets, skimming some last pages and leaving others unread. Again and again, I ask, "What about this one, Mom? Would you like this?" And then, would I like this? Because that matters too. Whenever I'm in front of a row of books, it's like I can hear Mom's loud yelp of a laugh, smell her warm lavender scent. On one occasion, Libby and I were so absorbed in our December 12th process that, for like 10 minutes, we failed to notice the man in the trench coat next to us doing his level best to expose himself. When this happened and I finally noticed, I heard myself calmly, disinterestedly say, a book still in my hand, no. The look on his face gave me the greatest surge of power I've had to date, and Libby and I laughed for weeks about what otherwise might have been a fairly traumatizing experience. So though I'm aware a couple of other people are milling around in my periphery, I don't exactly acknowledge any of them until I reach for January Andrews's novel, Curmudgeon, only to find someone else reaching for it at the same moment. Most people, I guess, would blurt, "Sorry." What comes out of my mouth is, "Ah!" Neither of us lets go of the book, typical city people, and I spin toward my rival, unwilling to back down. My heart stops. Okay, I'm sure it doesn't. I'm alive still. But this, I realize, is what they mean. All those thousands of writers who've tried to describe the sensation of following the trail of your life for years, only to smack into something that changes it forever. The way the sensation jars through you from the center out, how you feel it in your mouth and toes all at once, 12 tiny explosions. And then, an unfurling of warmth from your collarbone to your ribs, to thighs, to palms, like just seeing him has triggered some kind of chrysalis. My body has moved from winter into spring, all those scraggly little sprouts pushing up through a crush of snow. Spring, alive and awake in my bloodstream.
Stevens,
Charlie says softly, like a swear, or a prayer, or a mantra. What are you doing here? I breathe.
I'm not sure which answer to start with.
Libby, the realization vaults up through me. You're my gift? His mouth curves, teasing, but his eyes stay soft, almost hesitant.
In a way.
In what way?
Good books, he says carefully, is under new management.
I shake my head, trying to clear the fog. Your sister came through? He shakes his head.
Yours did.
My mouth opens, but no sound comes out. When I shut it again, tears cloud my eyes. I don't understand. But some part of me does, or wants to believe it does. It hopes, and that hope registers like a burning knot of golden, glowing thread, too tangled up to make sense of. Charlie slides the book, caught between our hands, back onto the shelf, then steps in close, his hands taking mine.
3 weeks ago, he says, I was at the shop, and our family showed up.
Our family?
I repeat.
Sally, Clint, Libby,
he says.
They brought a PowerPoint.
A PowerPoint? I say, my brow wrinkling. The corner of his mouth curves.
It was very organized,
he says.
You would have fucking loved it. Maybe they'll email you a copy.
I don't understand, I say. How are you here?
They put together a list,
he says.
12 steps to reunite soulmates, which, by the way, involved multiple Jane Austen quotes. Not sure if that was Libby or Dad, but what I'm getting at is, they made some compelling points.
Tears flood into my eyes, my nose, my chest. Such as? A full, bright smile. An electrical storm behind his eyes.
Such as, I'm desperate to see your Peloton in real life,
he says.
And I need to know if your mattress deserves the hype. And most importantly, I'm so fucking in love with you, Nora.
But your dad...
Graduated early from physical therapy,
he says.
The PowerPoint said with honors, but I'm 88% sure that's not a real thing. And Libby took over the store. The girls run wild there every day, and Tala arm wrestles anyone who tries to leave without buying anything. It's beautiful. Libby also said to tell you that she and Brendan are Manhattan destitute but North Carolina rich, so after the baby comes, Principal Schroeder is going to help out while Libby takes a leave. Then when she's ready to come back to work, she'll hire a nanny, so you should stop worrying before you even start.
I laugh wetly, shake my head again. You said your mom would never let someone outside the family run the store. His eyes settle on my face, his expression going serious.
I think she's hopeful Libby won't be outside the family forever.
That's it. The dam breaks, and I burst into sniffling, happy tears as Charlie frames my face with his hands.
I told my parents I couldn't leave them if they needed me. And you know what they said?
What?
My voice cracks about 4 times on that one syllable.
They said they're the parents.
His voice is damp, throttled.
Apparently they don't need jack shit from me, except for me to be happy. And they wouldn't mind a hot, sexy daughter-in-law.
I don't know whether to laugh or cry some more, or maybe just scream at the top of my lungs. Excited scream, not scared scream. Is that how you're supposed to say spa?
Exact quote from Sally?
I say. He grins.
Paraphrasing.
The knot is unbraiding, unsnarling in me, reaching upward through my throat and rooting down through my stomach as he goes on.
Nora Stevens,
he says.
I've racked my brain, and this is the best I can come up with, so I really hope you like it.
His gaze lifts. Everything about it, about his face, about his posture, about him, made up of sharp edges and jagged bits and shadows, all of it familiar, all of it perfect. Not for someone else, maybe, but for me.
I move back to New York,
he says.
I get another editing job, or maybe take up agenting, or try writing again. You work your way up at Loja, and we're both busy all the time, and down in Sunshine Falls, Libby runs the local business she saved, and my parents spoil your nieces like the grandkids they so desperately want, and Brendan probably doesn't get much better at fishing, but he gets to relax and even take paid vacations with your sister and their kids, and you and I, we go out to dinner. Wherever you want, whenever you want. We have a lot of fun being city people, and we're happy. You let me love you as much as I know I can, for as long as I know I can, and you have it fucking all. That's it. That's the best I could come up with, and I really fucking hope you say.
I kiss him then. Like there isn't someone reading one of the Bridgerton novels 5 feet away. Like we've just found each other on a deserted island after months apart. My hands in his hair, my tongue catching on his teeth, his palms sliding around behind me and squeezing me to him in the most thoroughly public groping we've managed yet.
I love you, Nora, he says when we pull apart a few inches to breathe. I think I love everything about you.
Even my Peloton?
I ask.
Great piece of equipment,
he says.
The fact that I check my email after work hours
just makes it easier to share a Bigfoot erotica without having to walk across the room, he says.
Sometimes I wear very impractical shoes,
I add. Nothing impractical about looking hot, he says.
And what about my bloodlust?
His eyes go heavy as he smiles.
That,
he says,
might be my favorite thing. Be my shark, Stevens.
Already was, I say. Always have been.
I love you,
he says again.
I love you too.
I don't have to force it past a knot or through the vice of a tight throat. It's simply the truth, and it breathes out of me, a wisp of smoke, a sigh, another floating blossom on a current carrying billions of them.
I know, he says. I can read you like a book.
Epilogue. 6 months later. There are balloons in the window, a chalkboard sign out front. Through the soft glare on the glass, you can see the crowd milling around, toasting with champagne flutes, talking, laughing, browsing. To the uninitiated, it might look like a birthday party. There is, after all, a little girl with strawberry blonde waves, newly 4 years old, who has stolen a cupcake from the tower of them at the back of the shop, and now runs in dizzying figure eights around the legs of the adults, knocking into chairs and shelves, purple icing smeared around her lips. Or the crowd could be celebrating her lanky older sister with the straight ashy bangs, who has finally, after some struggle, learned to read. Now she spends almost every day folded up in the green beanbag chair inside the children's book room with a book in her lap. Or it could all be for the baby on the pink-haired woman's hip. She crawled for the first time just 9 days ago, albeit backward and only for a second, and you'd think she'd won the Nobel Prize from the screaming on her mom and aunt's video call.
Do it again, kitty! Show Auntie No-No how you're the most agile, athletic baby of all time!
There's cause to celebrate the pink-haired woman's husband, too. After weeks of trailing along with the local catch-and-release club, he finally caught something early that morning while the mist was still thick across the river, even if it was just a very large bra. The cupcake-thieving four-year-old darts through his legs and runs smack into the tall older man using the cane. She giggles as he rustles her hair. Someone pats his arm and congratulates him on finally retiring.
More time to clean the gutters at home, he says.
Maybe everyone's here to honor the woman with the sweet, crinkly eyes who moves in a cloud of weedy jasmine. Two of her paintings have just been accepted into a group show. Or they could be celebrating that the shop hosting the party just had its most profitable month in 8 years. It could be that after months of working freelance, the thick-browed man with a pout of a smile has just accepted a job offer at Wharton House Books, a position several rungs higher than when he worked there the first time. Or this could all have something to do with the small velvet box he can't stop turning over in his jacket pocket. There's nothing inside it. She mentioned once that if she ever got married, she'd choose the ring herself. Or that the ice-blonde woman leaning against him has known for weeks already what she's going to say. She made a pro-con list, but only ended up writing his name under pro and possibly wear a piece of jewelry I didn't pick out for life under con. The party in question might also be for the woman in the Coke bottle glasses, clutching a champagne flute as she approaches the microphone in the center of the bookstore. A stack of slate-gray books arranged on a table beside her, a room of readers falling quiet, rapt, waiting for her to speak, to introduce this new story to a world that has been waiting for it.
For anyone who wants it all, she begins. May you find something that is more than enough.
She wonders whether what comes next could ever live up to the expectations. She doesn't know. You never can. She turns the page anyway.
This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Book Lovers by Emily Henry. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday, edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2022 by Emily Henry. Production copyright 2022 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.